This weekend will mark Juneteenth. It is the moment when the last slaves of the South in Texas learned of their freedom in 1865. Welcome to DeMarva Today. This is Don Rush. It was on June 19th, the end of the Civil War, that Union officials arrived in Galveston, Texas, with the news that the slaves had been freed. Stemmed from the Emancipation Proclamation issued 2 years earlier when slaves in the Confederate South were declared free by the stroke of Lincoln's pen. While many former slaves in Galveston celebrated upon hearing the news, those bright days were darkened as a new system of Jim Crow, another century of white supremacy, would dominate Southern politics. We have on the phone with us this morning Dr. Arlisha Norwood, history professor at the University of Maryland, Eastern Shore. She's also coordinating events for Juneteenth at the Historically Black College, and welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
So let's go back to that moment in time when General Gordon Granger arrives and he tells these people who had not heard the news, or at least the news had been kept from them, that indeed they were free.
So we know that General Granger arrived in Galveston, Texas, June 19th, 1865, as you stated, two years after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. I always, I love teaching about Juneteenth because it is just such a powerful story that it includes African Americans, the Civil War, just all of these amazing things. One of the biggest misconceptions about Juneteenth is that African Americans were not aware of their freedom. And I always like to break this down because we just are a cell phone generation. We assume that freedom was kept in secret, but it was not. In fact, African Americans in Texas knew that they were free. They were waiting on, this is the powerful moment, they were waiting on the enforcement of the Union Army, right? And so they knew they were free from the Emancipation Proclamation, which was signed in January 1st of 1863. And so what was happening is that they were there waiting for the Union to come in and enforce freedom. The last sort of supporters of the Confederacy were in Texas. They were holding, Texas was a stronghold of the Confederacy. And so then General Ulysses S. Grant had to send Union soldiers there to defeat these last Confederate soldiers. General Granger arrived. Many of the troops that he arrived with were African-American males, United States color troops. He arrives in Texas, and he basically forces the Confederate soldiers there to put down their weapons, thereby implementing or enacting freedom in Texas. African-Americans there are jubilant. They are happy about this this occasion, and they tend to celebrate it, or they start to celebrate it 1 year after June 19th, 1866. We know that they immediately take on the role of freedom very happily. One of the stories that I always tell is that in the WPA narratives, the last sort of interviews from former slaves, one of the women were free. She was freed on June 19, 1865. In the very next hour, she went to her former master and asked her for money. He asked her for the money she would do for her labor. And so from that moment on, I'm a Texas resident. I grew up celebrating Juneteenth at Emancipation Park in Houston, Texas. From that moment on, they celebrated in many ways. They had balls. They ate outside on cookouts. However they could, they would do it. I always also attach this transformation. It's because that we tend to think of freedom as being very static, right? We think that they received freedom and that was it. They were free from that moment forward, and that is just not the case. Even when the Civil War ended, or when the largest army in the Confederacy surrendered April 14th, 1865, that does not mean that freedom was static. The African Americans believed, or white Union soldiers believed, people just generally believed that the Confederacy could come back, declare war again, and the nation would be at odds again. And so African Americans celebrate Juneteenth while their freedom is in flux. They do not all think that slavery is over. They know that this day should be celebrated, though, and they continue to do that well into the 20th century. It picks up again around the 70s and 80s and continues in Texas for a very long time. But I've now, in my lifetime, I've seen it being celebrated, of course, here in Maryland and other places throughout the United States. And hopefully one day it will be a federal holiday. So it's a very exciting thing to see. We are making history now.
Let me just go back to Texas, because Texas, and I was just reading this recently, that Texas as an entity breaking away from Mexico, slavery was indeed the key issue for the now we know as famous names out of Texas. And that even during the Civil War, when things looked like it was going badly, as it were, there were some, I guess, thousands of slaves that were brought into Texas to keep them away from the Union and freedom.
Yes, Texas has always been, and I always call it, a stronghold of racism and white supremacy. And historian Annette Gordon-Ring has a great book about this called Juneteenth, which she talks about. Texas was created to appease slaveholders, slaveholders who were very much concerned about slavery being abolished in northern states. They were called to go to Texas. They received land based on the amount of enslaved people they had. And so Texas was built solely around slavery. Even during the Civil War, this is an interesting story. During the Civil War, slave owners would lead to Texas as the Union Army is taking over the South, right? As we get to Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, think about Confederate soldiers and slaveholders migrating west. They arrive to Texas, and this is exactly what happens. When they get there, they decide that freedom cannot be implemented here because there is no enforcement, and so those enslaved people remain enslaved until 1865. Afterwards, a lot of slaveholders, once hearing, right, this, there is no cell phone to text anyone that the Union is coming, but they are aware that General Granger is coming. Once hearing that General Granger is coming to Texas, they flee to Mexico, which is an interesting concept. They flee to Mexico, and this happens in Florida as well. They flee to Mexico with their enslaved people. And for a very long time, African Americans are enslaved in not just Texas, but in other parts of the country, well past June 19th, 1865, especially in the western portions of the country, just due to the Union Army not being there to enforce freedom.
So, once the slaves are free, what happens in Texas, in particular, because there is this period of Reconstruction, which then, of course, is eclipsed by the dismantling of it, as it were. Tell me a little bit about that process, because at one point there is this sort of burst, this idea that African Americans would get their place in the sun, as it were. There were obviously people, African Americans, who were elected in various states to Congress, for example. Down the road, particularly, I guess, 1876, that then begins to die. Tell me a little bit about that sort of burst of hope that certainly was betrayed.
So we know that Texas is included in the Reconstruction concept, or the policy of the Reconstruction. They're set up, and Reconstruction is partially successful in Texas. We do get elected officials in Texas, and if you're speaking about African Americans in larger cities, we know that Houston as a metropolis becomes like this promising urban city for African Americans in the state. Austin, same way. There are many communities, Freedmen's Village, I'm thinking of, in Houston, that represent these first sort of communities that African Americans set up after enslavement. They were successful on all means. You know, they had businesses, schools, all of those things were established. We know that after the Civil War, especially during Reconstruction, African Americans are solely interested in education, reuniting their families, and creating economic status. And they do just that in Texas. We also know that there is a large, large pushback against their freedom. We know that Texas is one of the most violent, like, I can't say one of the most, but many of the southern states, African Americans there experience violence like no other. There is a time during Reconstruction where there are race riots. We recently just celebrated 100 years of the Tulsa race riot, but if you comb the history of Reconstruction, it is the history of racial violence. There are numerous riots and protests, and they are deadly for African Americans. We know that where the Union Army stands, and that they stay in many places until 1872, where they stay, African Americans are safe. But as soon as a Union Army leaves, they experience violence and just this sort of pushback against their rights, be it voting, which we're aware of, our political activity, running for office, education. Schools are burnt in Texas, in a lot of the rural areas. And so it is not good. It is not a very successful. Reconstruction is successful for a time, but afterwards is very, again, in flux. They are not sure what is going on or how they're viewed in by their state government or federal government.
By the way, I want to go back just a moment because once the word was out and that the Union folks were there to enforce the abolition of slavery, was there a tendency for some people to still stay on the plantations? I ran across one account in which there was a woman who actually wound up staying for another 6 years with what seemed to be generally the same kind of treatment that she got as when she was an official slave. And what was that tension like there? Because it was the plantation obviously was the only thing that they had ever known, and they were sort of walking out into an unknown country, as it were.
So what is important to remember is that African Americans, once they find out they are free, they work to negotiate their freedom. And that is negotiating your work, your labor. And they are open to doing this, remaining on the space, remaining in the space that they had worked their entire lives, but now asking for payment. White slave owners absolutely refuse to pay them for their labor in most cases, and that is when we get the Freedmen's Bureau there to enforce labor contracts. It is a very, African Americans are tied to the land just as white slave owners are tied to the land, right? They are connected to these spaces by ancestors and all sorts of other things, and so they do choose to stay in those spaces. During Juneteenth or during the Union Army coming into Galveston, Texas, many of the enslaved people there also flee to urban cities, Houston, Dallas, Austin, those places, just to get a change of scenery. But they are tied to the, it's absolutely true that many stay on the land and ask to be paid for labor, and they are not paid, and that is when we get the Freedmen's Bureau to enforce those labor contracts, which the Freedmen's Bureau slightly successful in doing that in the early 20th century. We'll get sharecropping just because, as I stated before, African Americans are tied to this land. So many of them choose not to stay, just as you choose to stay, just as you say it.
And one of the things that struck me is that the sharecropping system, which may very well have begun as a way to adjust that relationship between the former slaves and white plantation owners, by the time Reconstruction's over, it seems to me that the white plantation owners and the white society in general had found a way to use that that system against the newly freed slaves.
They had sharecropping is a very, I think that African Americans are aware that sharecropping or enter into sharecropping contracts because they are interested in holding land. After the Civil War, during Reconstruction, no matter where you find formerly enslaved people, be it Virginia, Maryland, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, they are interested in a couple of things. That's education, reuniting with their families, but also creating economic strongholds in places that they are. And so they do enter into contracts with former slave owners. Former slave owners understand what passing wealth would mean, and that would mean giving up land, and that does not happen because they're unwilling to give up that power in the South, and it remains that way. In many states today, African-Americans are not necessarily majority landowners in many places because the wrongs have not been righted that happened during Reconstruction. That is one thing Frederick Douglass said, Thaddeus Stevens said. Everybody was very clear that in order to create a stronghold in their communities, African Americans needed to receive land, and they did not because of history. And so, yes, it was sharecropping was very, very tumultuous for African Americans.
And I want to turn to two quotes actually I found as the Country Moves On. One is by Episcopal Church and scholar Alexander Crummell. In 1885, he said that one should guard against not the memory of slavery, but the constant recollection of it, recommending a new people to emerge from it, as opposed to Douglas, who insisted on lighting the flame to the causes, the incidents, and the results of the late rebellion. In short, that we should never forget slavery, and whereas opposed to, say, Crummell was concerned about the idea that they would stay in that kind of, remembrance of that action, mm-hmm. of that existence.
Yeah, Alexander Crummell is referring to the status. So he after the Civil War and after Reconstruction, African-American leaders are clear that you are no longer a slave. You should not act like one. You should demand respect like the citizen that you have been. And Alexander Crummell is talking about that. Drop those ideas of being an enslaved person in this country and pick up the idea that you are a citizen and you have always been a citizen and ask for those rights. And on the opposite end, well, not really on the opposite end, but we have Frederick Douglass saying that we should always remind others of slavery. Frederick Douglass is a man who is pivotal to African Americans fighting in the Civil War, right? He's a man that after the Civil War understands that everything you have to fight for, every voting right you have to fight for, citizenship you have to fight for, you have to keep fighting. And so he would remind the public that if you want us to forget slavery, it will not happen because we're not treated equally. And so today, or during his family, we're not being treated equal at this moment. And so both of them are talking about this sort of complex juggling that is happening for African Americans during Reconstruction. They are both forcing people to acknowledge their citizenship, but also calling them to remember their status as it was and how many rights were taken away from them under that status.
And one of the things I'm reminded by is that it's Du Bois who wrote about the going back and looking at African Americans in the South and being struck by the fact that they had not made so much progress, leading obviously to the idea that you have to have some political push, you need to have laws, as opposed to, say, Booker T. Washington, who thought that African Americans would ultimately recognize that they were industrious. I mean, that seems to be two trends within the thinking as they kind of moved forward into the late 1800s.
Yes, and Du Bois, of course, changes his thoughts on Reconstruction with the publication of his book, Black Reconstruction in America. He publishes it in 1935 and basically says that Reconstruction was an outright failure for African Americans, but not because African Americans were a failure. It is because the government failed us and those in power failed us. And so we have, at the turn of the 20th century, we do have these two personalities, these two commanding personalities and historical characters who are, I guess one could say, on opposite ends, but they are working towards the same thing. And Booker T. Washington, his autobiography is called Up from Slavery, and so he is generally, he knows about slavery, right? He is a man who actually walked from his location to Hampton College to get an education. And so they are on opposite ends, but they are both working towards one goal, and that is to get African Americans to equality in this country. They know that they can go about it, be it the industrial way or, as W.B. Du Bois says, through the talented 10th, but they are on the same track, and they both remain on that track, Booker T. Washington until his death and W.E. Du Bois until his death in the 1960s. And so I don't like to place them at polar opposites because they are working towards the same goal. It just looks different for both of them. Du Bois was a staunch critic of Reconstruction. Like I said, in the 1930s, he understood that it did not matter how much work African Americans did. It was a systemic issue during the era that refused to let them, refused to acknowledge them as equals. And so,
let me ask you this, before we get into the celebrations, do you think things would have been different? That's a very hypothetical. Been different if Lincoln had lived?
Yeah, that's good. That's good. As a Civil War historian, I always wait for that. That's a good one. So, actually, I haven't been asked it in a long time. So, I do think things would have been different. It is hard. I think the American history would be different, though. I don't think this has to solely do with African-Americans, right? We know that Andrew Johnson is a very conservative president after Abraham Lincoln. We know that he's a Southerner from Tennessee, and so his thoughts about Reconstruction are always reconciliation. He's always interested in meeting with or appeasing Southerners, right? And so I do think things would have been different, but I don't think Reconstruction would have gone differently. And that is because I think that Lincoln would have realized that as we fought the Civil War, that white supremacy will just not, it does not end. It is not an easy fix. It is not a stroke of a pen through Emancipation Proclamation. It is not Union troops with violence. It does not end like that. And so I would like to think that after a few years of that, and perhaps around 1872, Lincoln would implement some stronger Reconstruction policies that included land possession, wealth inequality, and all of those things. But it's hard to say. I don't think Reconstruction would have gone differently, but maybe the first couple of months after the war would have gone differently. But I don't think Reconstruction is more about local communities refusing to acknowledge the federal government, thereby the Civil War. That is the Civil War. And so it would have been very difficult for Lincoln to change that narrative.
Yeah, because it strikes me that the white supremacy in the South, in particular, was so endemic. I mean, because slavery created this sort of the social caste system that the slavery created, and it just sort of obviously goes on into Jim Crow. And it does seem to me that the white supremacy was so endemic that one should probably have not have been surprised that it would take even another 100 years to get rid of the legal structure certainly whites occupied.
Yeah, I always, when I'm teaching about Reconstruction, that my students are always, you know, I hear this all the time, that voting rights were taken away. The voting rights were never taken away from African Americans. They put violent systemic issues in order to stop African Americans from voting. And I don't think that we really understand what sort of violence has to exist for you to stop someone from voting, right? It is an extremely, extremely violent era. I cannot stress that enough. African Americans are assaulted daily for anything, for walking on the wrong side of the sidewalk, and we think about these things in terms of Jim Crow, right? But during Reconstruction, it was a normal occurrence for African Americans to be beat down by white mobs. Black Union soldiers come home to, if they wear their uniforms out on the streets, it starts a riot. Women, African American women, are raped in some of these riots, and so there's a riot in Memphis. It is just one of the most violent eras in American history, and I always remind them, it has to be that violent for you to take someone's rights. That is the sort of violence that white supremacists depends upon, right, is that it has to be enacted daily and at a large level for you to take someone's rights in order for them to regain them 50 to 60 years later. And so it is 100 years later. it is mind-blowing to think about.
So I want to turn to the celebration itself. So it begins, obviously, in Galveston, Texas. So does it then spread out to other parts of the country? How aware are particularly African-American communities outside of, say, even the South, aware of this particular celebration? What's the history here?
So, I grew up celebrating Juneteenth. I did not know that it was celebrated in other places until I moved to Maryland in 2012. What I do know is that Emancipation Day is different for different communities. Emancipation, even on January 1st of 1863, different people feel at different times. In Washington, D.C., there is an Emancipation Day. In Florida, there is an Emancipation Day that is not June 19th, 1865. I think if you think about emancipation as this moving sort of idea or concept, that allows you to imagine emancipation happening at different places in the United States throughout the Civil War. And so different years celebrate different terms. In Washington, D.C., they celebrate Emancipation Day in April. They still celebrate it. It's a holiday here in Washington, D.C., and so they celebrate. Also, the idea of emancipation does not always come through the Emancipation Proclamation, right? And so in D.C. they celebrated in April, but they also celebrated a different kind of emancipation that Lincoln implemented, and that was compensated emancipation, right? The slave owners here who freed their slaves are in I don't live in Washington, D.C., so I don't know why I'm saying here. The slave owners in Washington, D.C., who freed their slaves were compensated for their slaves. And so it looks different in a lot of places for most of the 19th century, and I would argue for most of the 20th century. I don't think it is until these last couple of years where people have picked up on June 19th as a national day. And I totally get the ideas behind it, but I think it also may skew Civil War history. Emancipation does not come one day at one time. If you are a member of an African-American church, it is also likely that you celebrated Emancipation Day on January 1st. Because of the Emancipation Proclamation, watch night services, African-Americans were watching for freedom to come at midnight. And so there are a lot of different celebrations, but I think in the last couple of years, again, we are always seeing history happen. We've seen sort of this gathering around 1865. And as a Texan, I'm overjoyed. I would love to see everybody celebrate this Texas holiday. But yeah, it's something new happening, which is exciting to watch.
And I understand that there is a Juneteenth flag. Describe for me some of the elements of it, because we have the Ark, the White Star, burst into white, and I guess they've added a date later on. Tell me a little bit about the significance of that.
So the Juneteenth flag, it not mimics, but it is very similar to the American flag. The designers did that on purpose. We know that there's a burst in the middle for jubilation, and also the Lone Star State, the Texas flag. The red, white, and blue colors communicate about that. All African Americans are Americans, and they should be a part of American history. And it was, you know, approved very. I mean, if you're talking about the same flag, there's also the green, red, and black flag. That is just the UNIA flag or the flag design by Marcus Garvey, and that was the Pan-African flag. And so you may see two. You may see the red, white, and blue that I'm speaking of, or you may see the green, red, and black one that just represents Pan-Africanism.
Now, I believe that Texas recognized the day somewhere around 1980.
Yes. Very early. In Texas, there is in Houston, I can only speak to Houston, there is a large parade that happens, and I remember going to as a young girl, and I've been to many of them.
We seem to be at a recognition point. We have certainly Confederate symbols and statues coming down. There seems to be a major reassessment now, a recognition. Even around the debate about race and being taught in schools and so on, there's a battle obviously over that now. But it does seem as if the country is coming to some kind of reckoning with its past. How that'll play out, of course, is we'll see. But do you think that's true? Do you think that there's a pivotal point here at this moment?
I do. I'm always optimistic about the country. As those enslaved people, as those three people who celebrated Juneteenth, again, not knowing if freedom was going to happen for sure or not, will it be taken away the next day? Will the Confederacy come back? They celebrated nonetheless. I think we're moving towards, as we're talking, I'm you know, saying to you that an African-American holiday will become a local African-American holiday will become a national African-American holiday, and that just has to do with this country recognizing the importance of African-American history and realizing that African-American history is American history. And so I do think we are moving towards that. I think as far as Civil War history, we have a long way to go with that push, with African-Americans being included in that story. But I do think that we are moving forward. We have we've had a black president. We have a African American woman as vice president, and so those markers that we are supposed to hit as a country, we are hitting some of them. Others, we should point it out. We have a long way to go, but the discussions are happening, and that is what we can do. We are facing an uphill battle. And I don't know if we will see this dream of equality in my generation, but I'm hoping that it is in my child's or the generation after. I don't know if it'll happen to mine, but I'm hopeful that it will happen soon.
We've been speaking with Dr. Arlisha Norwood. She's a history professor at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, also coordinating events around Juneteenth at the Historically Black College. Appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.